Funds for Bookworm are provided in part by Lannan Foundation.
You are a human animal. You are a very special breed. For you are the only animal who can think, who can reason, who can read.
Hello, and welcome to Bookworm from KCRW Santa Monica. I'm Michael Silverblatt, and today my guest is Steve Martin. Steve Martin has written a novel called Shop Girl, a collection of pieces in the Robert Benchley mode, pure drivel. Early on, there was Cruel Shoes, plays, Wasp and other plays, Picasso and the La Pinagille, at the La Pinagille. And I thought it would be interesting because the novel shows that this is someone who is learning to be a writer. I thought it would be fascinating to talk about that process of of learning to write. What struck me immediately about the book and endeared me to it is the loneliness, otherworldliness, and oddness of the heroine. And I guess I'm attracted to loneliness in some deep and complicated way. And
well, you do work in a little cell here.
Yes, I do. but I weirdly felt that the level of compassion for her indicated some familiarity with distance or loneliness from the world of your own. Is that true?
You know, it's hard to answer for myself because certainly, yes, I have had periods of my life that have been lonely when I was traveling, doing my stand-up act, a different town every night. And you're actually too famous to have friends because I know that sounds arrogant, but it's not too famous to have friends. It's too – you can't go out without being besieged in a kind of overly familiar way. And so you become kind of an object. And so you tend not to go out because you don't want to be – I don't know. It's something uncomfortable about it for me. Other people really enjoyed it. So there is an isolation. I mean, not now. And I've always made a decision. I'm never going to have a bodyguard or – by the way, I'm talking about in the late 70s, you know, when I was very popular as a stand-up. And I'm just not going to do that. I'm going to go places by myself. I'm not going to have an entourage. So sometimes you did make the choice to stay in if you were in a small town that is not used to celebrities or something.
Well, back then I remember, you know, I'm someone who doesn't necessarily feel safe when things are popular.
Right. Yeah.
And back then you would compare something to Prince Mishkin in The Idiot. And I'd say, oh, well, here's a comedian who knows what it's like to have read a devastating book.
Right.
And I wondered, you know, was writing in the background?
No. Actually, well, in a way, I started as a writer for television, writing for the Smothers Brothers Comedy Hour. And that was like learning anatomy because you learn economy in a sentence. You know, television is straightforward jokes. You learn how to write the joke. You learn how to think in sort of traditional structures. I mean, there's traditional structures of a joke, and then there's the untraditional, the kind of joke that is all of our favorites when you don't know why it's funny. And so always in anything, I think in humor, if you watch a comedian, they'll have a kind of straightforward humor, straightforward structures, and then suddenly there'll be the oddest, weird thing. And you need the traditional in order to get to the odd, weird thing. Otherwise, it would all be odd and weird. So I don't even know where we started talking. But that's how I started writing jokes. And then, of course, I was writing stand-up comedy for my act. But that's writing in the sense of thinking on your feet, trying a line out here and there, and then thinking, oh, that worked, I'll add some more material to it. It's not really writing like authors do. And then in the 80s, I started co-writing screenplays. We wrote The Jerk and The Man with Two Brains and Dead Men Don't Wear Plaid and Three Amigos. And then I started writing on my own, screenplays on my own. I did Roxanne and L.A. Story, Simple Twist of Fate. I said L.A. Story. And that's when I started writing alone. And I found that was quite a different experience. And all along I'd been writing, well, actually not all along. In the 90s, I started writing these little comic essays for The New Yorker. And that's when I became an actual sentence writer and started thinking about it and learning about it and finding little pathways through one essay into another essay with a, you know, a bigger theme or more elegant sentence.
What were you reading? What helped you along?
What was I reading? Mm-hmm. Well, it's everything and nothing. You know, I was reading a lot of magazines, a New Yorker, books, fiction and nonfiction, but I wasn't voracious. So it's hard for me to even know what I was reading. Mostly what influenced me as a writer I read in college, which would have been T.S. Eliot, and the ones that stuck with me, T.S. Eliot, Dylan Thomas, and E.E. Cummings, et cetera. And then in modern life, I think maybe Martin Amis. I really enjoyed his sentences. And I found that even when he was, not on story, that the sentences were so entertaining.
Well, there's a point, I think, in one of the books where the hero is described as smelling like a camel coated with mustard. And you think to yourself, well, where did that come from?
Yeah.
You know, camel would have been plenty. the mustard, too,
yeah.
Pegs it. And I could see that kind of thing appealing to you. But what interested me, I met my guest, Steve Martin, at the National Book Awards this year. He's been generously acting as host for that ceremony. And sitting at the table was Salman Rushdie, who had been a guest. And Salman turned to me and said, you know, Steve is very serious about writing. He's been reading all kinds of modern literature, and he's really devoted to this practice. And I wondered, was he being accurate? Was he pulling?
Well, he's accurate in the sense that I am. I feel devoted to it, but it's not. You know, my devotion or my inspiration really doesn't come from the joy of it. Doesn't come from applying what I've read in others. The joy of it, I mean, that's its own pleasure. The joy of it for me, who knows what the influences are? Of course, you might read something and then find yourself subconsciously recreating it in another form, which is not my original thought, but Douglas Hofstadter's original thought that creativity is like a virus, that someone sees something, it goes into their brain, and it's changed and altered to the point of invisibility or of relating it to the original thought. And then someone sees that thought, and pretty soon these things are so transmogrified that they're unrecognizable. But really the joy of writing for me is in, one, internal exploration, sort of liberating your subconscious or your unconscious, and two is in the joy of construction.
Now, in the novel Shop Girl, which is published by Hyperion and recently has come out in paperback, there were a couple of characters in romantic comedies that the heroine reminded me of, the woman in the shop around the corner, mm-hmm. and the woman in Billy Wilder's The Apartment, loneliness. And it struck me that she was being, in a sense, plucked off the screen, put behind a counter at Neiman Marcus, and then subjected to some amount of real life, that this was not a heroine, at least in the opening pages, that I feared for her.
You know, that you did fear for her.
I did fear for her.
Yes.
You know, in a certain way, I there's a writer named Charles Baxter who says that writing, as opposed to movies, is about the world where things get worse. And in this particular book, there is a romantic ending, and I, in a sense, wanted to know what Chekhov would have told us about this girl, that is to say, how she lived with the problems that couldn't be solved. And I wondered about the decision to give it, to rescue her.
Let's put it this way. The ending, what happens to her, in a way, is superfluous. What happens to them is the tragedy of the story. So this is a girl who was going to go on to something. She was not going to stay in her lonely, isolated state, because most people don't. They pass through it. They pass through it in a period of time. And there is no – in the book, there is no happy ending for Ray. There's a neutral ending for Ray. But their relationship is a sad, tragic – has a sad, tragic end, although it's a normal end to many relationships. As I was writing it, I felt if this book ends in this Hopper-esque, tragic, lonely place, the book has no point. The thing about a misguided relationship is that it teaches you about the next one. Sometimes we learn the lesson, sometimes we don't. But in this case, I think it did in the book. And you move on to a different kind. What she found out was she the next person that was with her was her peer. And the next person that was with Ray Porter was his peer, or is implied, although that relationship doesn't work out. It's just a paragraph in the book, and it's unimportant, really, what happens to Ray. And I was writing it, you know, these characters, as you know, and you've talked to many writers, they live. And I found it cruel to leave her standing there, empty and with nothing. It was almost like, as I was writing, there are situations where, for example, she's alone on Thanksgiving Day. Now, I could have left her alone on Thanksgiving Day. It had to be horribly tragic. But the joy of having her saved by having someone show up to have dinner with her was so exhilarating as a writer that you really want to do it. And in the book, you know, you can save someone, whereas sometimes life can't.
Now, I'm struck by the difference between Shop Girl and some of the plays, because they seem to me to be genuinely surrealist plays in which sort of ordinary events have water balloons of surrealism thrown at them. I wondered about your sense of the difference between the audiences.
Well, I think there's a big difference. And I think that's why in the plays, you know, you're thinking of the play, the story, but also entertainment. And my head as an entertainer goes to surrealistic places. It goes to surprises, at least in the things I've written so far. So that's why I think the plays are riddled with surrealistic elements, because I find them entertaining too. And what I also found is that those, you know, kind of, that kind of wild thought can lead you to a place of poignancy that I couldn't have gotten to. I, as an author, couldn't have gotten to by going straight.
Well, it's funny because, see, I want to be straightforward here. I found when I was reading The Zigzag Woman that this was a genuinely avant-garde play.
Oh, really?
You know, no. It seemed to me to be, you know, a mind-body split, and literally so, and very unusual things are happening. And what's more, I always felt that at your most extraordinary as a performer, that you had made the avant-garde friendly to audiences who felt safer laughing than being mystified.
Well, I got a review once in the 70s when I was doing my stand-up act as a person. You know, I was under a lot of criticism, too, because I was popular. So that always provokes a lot of criticism, negative criticism.
Not from me.
Well, thanks. No, there was a lot of positive and there's a lot of negative. And one woman wrote, she said, I like Steve Martin because he brought surrealism to the masses. But, you know, surrealism was not my goal. My goal in my stand-up was much different, which was to liberate myself, you know, in comedy. This comedy had become very bound up by politics. And nobody had been silly for a long, long time. This would have been the Vietnam War era and post-Vietnam War. So I felt I had, you know, in my own little sense, something to say. Although it was a very stupid thing to say, but it was a, you know, it was a human thing to say. It's like, let's have fun.
Well, pardon me, because I thought it was more than fun.
Well, I put quotes around it. I mean, there's a lot of different aspects to, in my head, to what I did, but it sounds pretentious because comedy's comedy. It's comedy either funny or it isn't. So in my, I really believe in that authors, creative people can operate very successfully by having theories and manifestos. But they, let's put it this way, if the futurist manifesto failed to produce great works of art, it would be as stupid to sit there and spout it. The works of art are the ones that are speaking, not the theory. The artist keeps the theory a secret, produces the odd thing without explaining it, and then ideally, you know, erases the theory and doesn't tell anybody the theory and let other people enjoy it and work it out, because the theory affects seeing.
You're listening to Bookworm. I'm Michael Silverblatt, and I'm talking with Steve Martin about his novel Shop Girl, published in paperback by Hyperion.
Now, Shop Girl immediately became a bestseller, and there's a lot of people, I think, interested in it, and yet it's not what readers expect. It is not going to make readers unhappy. In fact, it will make them feel warm and kind of joyful by the end of the book. But as you start to write novels, are you playing with what people expect from Steve Martin?
Not at all. Like in Bowfinger, I just wanted to write something that was funny. And so in that sense, yes, I am thinking of the audience. I want it to be freewheeling. I want it to be funny. I want to have scenes that are built to, and when those two characters walk in the room, it's the joy I felt when I've seen movies like that, when I go, uh-oh, something really funny going to happen. I wanted to do those. So in that sense, in those efforts, I am thinking about the audience. In something like Shop Girl, I'm really not thinking about the audience. I didn't even know if it would be published. When I started writing the play, Picasso at the Lap d'un Agile, I didn't know if it would ever be on stage. It was just, you know, it's one of those dumb things that you do that turns out to be your best thing.
Joy seems to be an important byproduct of this for you. Or at least I recognize that by the end of Picasso, I'm participating in the joy of the character's discovery of what beauty is in that century. And in Shop Girl 2, there's a warm feeling of coming on a book, in fact, where someone woebegone, that old-fashioned word, is rescued. And it's almost like a gentlemanliness or fairness that if you're going to take the time with my book, I'm not going to leave you starving out in the snow looking for crumbs.
Right. I agree with that there has to be a delivery. And of course, you know, books don't have to be happy or anything or sad, or they are what they are, and they are what they really reflect their own story. I mean, Shop Girl, I feel, for me, really is very close to what I wanted to do, in meaning that it's tone. I wanted to talk about that tone of that girl. The tone of her spirit, I believe, is in the book. And whatever happens, this happens, that happens, that we like or don't like, that the real, for me, the accomplishment of, for me, of the book is that it does express mood.
Well, I think that the outsider as mood, it's there in Roxanne too, the pleasure of being on the side of someone who feels left out and knows, in fact, that he or she is better than the ones who are inside, you know, in some private way. Mirabelle draws, and she doesn't really explain to her parents what she draws. She doesn't go around telling people that she's really an artist, but there's a kind of private knowledge that she has. It's almost as if she wouldn't have it in her to say, this is what allows me to cope with the world as I find it. But I find that quality. I wish that I could, you know, give you a kind of ultimate statement of this. But I think that ordinary people are appealing to you. And I think that what was so moving to me about the comedy was that, you know, putting an arrow on the head is what someone who's not very funny does at a party in order to be funny. Like people.
Well, that's exactly right. That's exactly the way I looked at it was, isn't it funny that someone would think this is funny?
Right.
And that's what my act was.
Right. As a result, if you thought about it, it had this immensely touching quality too, because you knew that someone who would do this at a party would have to be very lonely and wrong, do you know? And, and, you know, the world is full of us lonely, wrong folk, you know? And it seemed like, if you'll pardon my pretension, the apotheosis of the lonely, wrong guy, you know?
Well, yeah, I agree with you. That Carl Reiner once told me, he said, your act is like someone who looked at Fred Astaire and said, I can do that.
But, you know, it turned out in that scene in Pennies from Heaven that you could.
I mean, well, I could for 5 minutes with a lot of rehearsal.
But it was astonishing to watch you small against that huge image of Fred Astaire. And in a way, I my mind is just given to these things. But I do think that you dancing next to the image of Fred Astaire is like pure drivel next to Robert Benchley, that there's often a figure who's being danced with, in a sense. But have you studied period styles?
No, only like all of us, by osmosis. I like my premise in writing Picasso at the Lapin Argile, which is set in 1904. I said, when I first said it, I said, I want this to be able to play at midnight in a coffee house or a nightclub. That's what I want it to be. I want it to be a late night event, and I want it to be freewheeling. And period, we're not about period. I'm going to break period. Not you know, there's some jokes in the play that are anachronistic, which, you know, are there for the joke. But it's not, it's, but I don't mean I want to be anachronistic throughout the play. It means I want to be freewheeling with the period. And I want it to look American. I'm adapting a play right now, The Underpants by Carl Sternheim. It'll be done in New York in April. And that's another thing I wanted to bring to it. I wanted it to be American. I didn't want to represent a German period play, even though it is a surreal. That, it's not surreal. It's a farcical kind of parody satire play, but it's very hard to capture satire and parody that was done in 1911.
Well, it's hilarious because I read it in preparation for this interview, the German play, and the author says, I very distinctly wanted to have middle-class people talking for three acts about a man whose wife lost her underpants. That's all I wanted. And I wanted to go on. And I wanted it to be, you know, scandalous and expostulatory. And I wanted them all to be talking in a very stilted middle-class way. How did you adapt it?
Well, the first thing you do is read the original translation 50 times so you can actually figure out what's happening. Because sometimes the translations and adaptations themselves are skewed and you can't quite get to what the core of a scene was. But I then the play was, at least as it presented to me, or I was tried to be influenced by people who said, this is about middle-class society and how horrible they are. And that's not something I wanted to say anyway. But there's something about in the play that I found to be quite rich, and that is the subject of ephemeral fame. In the play, the woman's underpants fall down in public, and it completely changes her life for a couple of weeks. And that I found something that our society could relate to and was worth discussing.
When is it going to be done?
It opens April 4th of 2002.
It's very interesting. Do you find now that the writing is more satisfying than the acting and the personal appearances?
Well, I don't do personal appearances anymore. I just do acting. Or I'd like to do David Letterman and, you know, go on TV shows every once in a while. It's usually in conjunction with the promotion of something. I really enjoy that. I get a big thrill from it. But it also produces a lot of anxiety. And writing produces no anxiety except once every 2 years when you come out with something. I enjoyed doing the Oscars. And let's put it this way. I'll give you the answer more succinctly. They're so different. Acting is public. It's done in presence of others. There are other people around. You joke. You laugh. You do the scene. You might cry. You might, etc. Writing is internal, private, solitary, and you really explore your own mind.
I've been speaking to Steve Martin on the occasion of the paperback publication by Hyperion of his novel Shop Girl. Thank you very much for joining me.
That's it?
That's it.
My God.
You can read the first chapter of Shop Girl on the Bookworm page at kcrw.com. My associate producer is Melinda Siegel. The engineer is Ray Guarna. Special production assistance from Alan Howard. I'm Michael Silverblatt. Join me again next week on Bookworm.
To the jungles you can go in books.
Funds for Bookworm are provided in part by Lannan Foundation. This program is produced in the studios of KCRW Santa Monica. Archived editions of this and other Bookworm programs can be found online at kcrw.com, keyword Bookworm. Cassette copies are available. For ordering information, call 310-450-5183.
They're your treasured friends in prose and rhyme. Now with the book of the mouse, pop time.
I want to tell you about a new show from the Financial Times called Life and Art from FT Weekend, hosted by me, Lila Raptopoulos. Life and Art is twice a week. On Mondays, I have a guest on to talk about life and how to live a good one. Everything from winter travel to cooking to living more creatively. And on Fridays, we talk art. Two FT journalists and I discuss a piece of culture that's in the air. New music, movies, and more. Find Life and Art from FT Weekend wherever you listen.